Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, in our interactive Talking Green segment, we discuss bovine growth hormone. Some say it hurts cows and humans. Others say it's a scientific breakthrough and gives us more milk. An environmental success story. The Northeast was once seriously deforested. Now, 100 years later, the trees are back. And it's sheep shearing time in New England. While most sheep herders use electric shears, a few do it the old-fashioned way. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is going interactive at a new segment called Talking Green. We want to hear from you about environmental issues. Call us or email us, and we'll ask you to join us on the air. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has the details.
We at The Environment Show have learned over the years that we have great listeners, and we want you involved. In our new interactive segment, Talking Green, we hear from people just like you about the critical environmental stories of the day. If you have an issue you'd like to see us explore, call us at 1-800-323-9262 and go to extension 600. That's 1-800-323-9262 and go to extension 600. You won't get on the air right away, but you'll be able to leave a message for one of our producers who will get back to you. You can also email us about anything you've heard on The Environment Show or about subjects you'd like to hear us cover. The address is envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or go to our webpage where you can see our topic of the week and listen to The Environment Show. We're at www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Recently, we talked green about the bovine growth hormone. Here's Peter Burley.
Welcome to Talking Green, a time in the Environment Show when we hear from you. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Our number is 1-800-323-9262, extension 600. And we're discussing the environmental and health questions relating to a practice of feeding a chemical known as RBGH, or the bovine growth hormone, to cows to increase their milk production. Some BGH is produced by the cow naturally and is found in her body. The biologically engineered product, which is fed to her by the farmer to make her give more milk, is produced by the Monsanto Company. In addition to controversies about the use of BGH, there are also questions about labeling milk. In some states, labeling milk as RBGH-free is not permitted. We ask the question then, does feeding RBGH have environmental consequences? What are they? Should consumers worry about whether milk from RBGH-fed cows is identified on the bottle or carton? What do you think? We have two guests with us. One is Professor Joe Cummins, who is recently retired professor of genetics from the University of Western Ontario in Canada. He's published over 100 scientific publications in genetics specifically dealing with the environmental mutation related to genetic engineering. He strongly believes that super-resistant bacteria is being created as a major side effect of RBGH. Also with us is Dr. Wayne Calloway from the Dairy Coalition in Washington, D.C. He's a professor of medicine at George Washington University and practices internal medicine and endocrinology in Washington. So, Professor Cummins, let me start with you. Are the environmental consequences from the use of RBGH something we need to worry about?
Definitely. I think we should have more than a little concern, principally because RBGH is associated with the high incidence of mastitis, a disease of the udder of the cattle, which causes inflammation, leading to treatment with antibiotics. Then I think we must be concerned. In the past, the concern is focused on whether or not the antibiotics get into the milk. That can easily be controlled. However, the side effect that I am mainly concerned about is the production in the farm from the cattle and spreading to the farmer and his family of antibiotic tolerant or super bacteria, and there's a wealth of evidence and clear demonstrations of exactly how that works. In this instance, it's been shown that the bacteria that cause the diseases will spread, and because they're antibiotic tolerant, they cannot be treated, and they'll be spreading first to the from the farmer, his clothing, and incidental items to his children, and hence to classes at school. And in about 6 months, in one case in the late 1980s of a similar spread where it was well documented, in 6 months it has spread through over two-thirds of the United States, the western two-thirds.
Well, clearly, from your perspective, the consequences are significant. Dr. Calloway, what is your take on that?
Well, I think the milk from cows that have been treated with injections of bovine somatotropin or bovine growth hormone is universally acknowledged by the various expert panels who reviewed this, including myself, who reviewed it in great detail, to be safe for human consumption and doesn't differ in its nutrient content or in any other significant way than milk from cows making their own bovine somatotropin. There's just more milk if it's used properly. As far as the antibiotic question, these are the kind of issues that expert panels will look at with expertise, including infectious disease experts. And all of the panels, including the Food and Drug Administration's, although they raised these questions, felt comfortable that the methods that existed for protecting the public would continue to operate. And as of last May, 18-month follow-up data was presented to the Food and Drug Administration here in Washington. And there was no increased evidence of increased mastitis. If anything, it may have been less than the herds getting BST. There was no increase in the milk that was condemned because of antibiotic residues and no increase in use of antibiotics. So it's one of those things that you think of when you're on a committee, you raise the question, you look at the data, and then you follow up, as has been done, to see if the experts were wrong. And so far, the experts seem to have anticipated things pretty well, and the data don't support the hypothesis that Dr. Cummings was concerned about.
Good. Well, thank you. We've got obviously divergent views here. Let's go to the phones. I see we have a call from Mike Asher in Alabama. Mike, what's your question?
Yes, hi. I know that other advances in the past have met with the same sort of problems that BGH is having. Congress held hearings on banning the gas-powered engine when it was invented, and the Royal Society of London attempted to ban electricity when they were trying to implement that.
Too bad they didn't succeed. then you wouldn't have to listen to us on the radio.
My question is, would you say that the hysteria surrounding BGH is more the same, and what would you suggest we can do to counter it?
Well, Professor Cummins, what do you think?
I think, first of all, that the data actually coming from Monsanto in the official hearings, this is public, it certainly did clearly show that mastitis was a problem, particularly in the warmer regions of the country. The mastitis effect has been well documented, and if newer panels are reporting otherwise, then I'd question the verity or the truthfulness of the newer panels, and I think the whole matter should go into independent investigation. Definitely, I think there is a more than legitimate concern, not only with mastitis and the bacteria, but with the insulin-like growth factor. Studies, genetic studies with animals indicated that the animals subject to higher levels of bovine growth hormone were suffering from decreased libido, which means that they were becoming more passive and less sexually active. And I think this passivity may be transmitted to the public, and they may have become too placid to respond to the problem.
Dr. Calloway, are you becoming increasingly passive as you take all of this milk in?
I'm 55. You don't ask a 55-year-old man about passivity or libido. Again, we have this issue. One, the data that were presented in the post-approval review, and there will be other reviews coming up, were, if anything, more extensive than the pre-approval review. And one has to depend upon one's peers to evaluate it. I certainly I've spent some time in government, and I certainly wouldn't want my opinions to be the rule of law. And this is why you get put together expert panels, and you sometimes they can be wrong, but it's the best judgment we have in terms of how to sort that out. As far as things like insulin-like growth factors, I'm an endocrinologist and was on the staff at Bayo for a long time, and one of the unfortunate things is the few people who brought this issue up have no background in hormones. And insulin-like growth factor is an essential hormone that we need to grow and to repair wounds and so forth. We make very large amounts of it ourselves every day. The amount that is in milk, whether the cow's been treated with BST or not, is very small. And it's a protein, so it gets digested. It doesn't get absorbed, and it's not biologically active. And even if it were active, it is such a, you know, it's about 1/100,000th of the amount that we would make in a day. So this is the kind, again, the kind of thing that when you put experts together, you get them to brainstorm, and then you get the ideas out and say, now, does this have any biological plausibility, or is there any data at all to support it? And there's clearly no biological plausibility to the concern about trace amounts of a hormone that's already in the milk to begin with. So, you know, what do you do? There will be mistakes made, and there certainly have been from experts in the past, but the batting average is better when you're dealing with a group of people who are immersed in the field and they can pit their ideas against each other than if you take any one of our ideas by itself, especially when we get outside of our area of expertise.
So, well, I think, first of all, that I should point out that there is, of course, a wealth of rebuttal information, and I believe in all of these experiences that that such opinions have come from qualified witnesses. It's a lawyer's approach to suggest the credibility of others' witnesses, and I think we should really try to focus on the evidence.
Okay, I'm going to see if we can move on. And, Mike, thanks for your call. We have an email question here that I think is relevant. It comes from Eden Danaher. And the question is, why use a genetically engineered hormone to force cows to produce more milk? This is wasteful, and the cows would require supplemental food sources to support increased production. This will have to be paid for by the farmers who would be earning less. What is the upside of the use of the hormone? Gentlemen, what do you say?
Well, Calloway here. I think it's an economic and animal husbandry decision. And I don't think farmers would use it if it's not going to be economically to their advantage. As a physician and as a consumer looking at this, I'm impressed by the fact that if milk production can be greater with fewer animals in the herd, there are some potential environmental benefits to this.
I obviously disagree with Joe Cummins, and I definitely disagree with this. From what I've been reading and what I've been hearing, I do get the distinct impression that there is a good deal of pain involved for the animals, that they are stressed to an extreme at this level of production, and mastitis is just one of those effects, but that's just what I have read and understand, and we should really have some concerns for the welfare of the animals, particularly as there's been serious questions as to whether we really do need and use that excess production.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both. We have heard from Professor Joe Cummins, who is retired professor of genetics for the University of Western Ontario, and Dr. Wayne Calloway, who is with the Dairy Coalition in Washington and a professor of medicine at George Washington University. And we've heard from all of you. For those left on the line, I apologize, but thank you for joining us. You're Talking Green on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. 200 years ago, most forests in the northeastern United States were clear. Today, they've grown back, but in a different way. And it's sheep shearing time. We'll visit a sheep farm where shearing is done by hand. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. The Earth has changed dramatically in the past 200 years. Human populations have exploded, and land has been cleared for settlement and agriculture. In this country, Massachusetts was one of the first states to be cleared for human settlement. Ancient forests were turned into farms, and sparsely populated valleys became hubs of activity. In the central part of the state, Harvard University owns a large tract of woods where they've carefully kept records on the forest for nearly 100 years. The story of the Harvard Forest reveals a hardy but heavily altered ecosystem. As we cut down our remaining virgin forests, it's a story that may have significance the world over. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
The Harvard Forest looks like any other woods in central Massachusetts. It's late autumn and the leaves have fallen. We're still awaiting our first snowfall, but the ground is hard and the air is cold. Hardwoods like oak, maple, and hickory are interspersed with pines, hemlocks, and firs. The history these woods tell is not obvious, but if you look closely, the trees, soil, and rocks tell a tale of violent natural disasters and extensive human activity. David Foster is the director of the Harvard Forest. He points to a stand of woods which were once fields and pasture for a farm long since gone.
One of the things that we've come to realize by studying these forests for a long time is that so many of the modern characteristics of the forest, both in terms of the trees, but also just in terms of the way the soils operate, the animals and smaller plants that you find, are determined by what happened 200 or 300 years ago.
At one point, New England boasted enormous old-growth forests, which were cleared for agriculture when settlers arrived in the 1700s. By the late 1800s, many farms were abandoned as the Industrial Revolution drew people to cities. The old farms grew back as pine forests, which were logged extensively till about the turn of the century. The new woods are mostly hardwoods. David Foster says this pattern of disturbance and regrowth is repeated throughout the world as nature and humans bring about change. What happened here may offer a clue to how deforested lands elsewhere in the world will grow back.
Well, the story of this change in landscape transformation is a phenomenal one, and it's a very positive one in the sense that forests are incredibly resilient and have come back in a fantastic way across this landscape. On the other hand, it's very clear from all the evidence that we've been able to amass that the forests today are completely unlike any of the forests that have grown on these sites in the past. And there's absolutely no evidence that the forest is growing back towards those original conditions.
Foster says it takes about 400 to 500 years for a forest to recover from a major natural disturbance. So it's not surprising that the forests in Massachusetts, which have only been growing for a little over 100 years, look so different from the way they did in pre-settlement days. John O'Keefe is the head of the Fisher Museum at the Harvard Forest. He says the new forest is different, but still quite functional.
For much of the historical period, much of what happened was not done particularly responsibly. The forest, despite our fairly intensive abuse, has come back and responded not to be the same forest, but to be a very beautiful, healthy forest. And so I think, you know, it has an ability to provide both useful products and aesthetic and spiritual benefits as well.
In these forests, it's common to come across stone walls from old farms. You can also see trees still affected from past hurricanes. Disturbance is a natural part of the forest. 15,000 years ago, during the Ice Age, this part of the world was buried in more than a half mile of ice. David Foster says nature is resilient if given the chance.
We now have forests across 90% of this portion of central Massachusetts, and yet 150 years ago, most of the landscape was cleared agricultural land. So we have a very new set of conditions that's changing very rapidly and is reverting back to a remarkably wild state, and yet it's not an original state.
Bill McKibben points out in his book, Hope, Human, and Wild, that a satellite photo of the Northeast in the 19th century would have shown a bald spot where forests once existed. Today the forests are back, albeit vastly different from the ones that used to be here. McKibben calls it nature's grace. Somehow, after decimating the forest, another one has taken its place. McKibben sees woods like the Harvard Forest as a second chance. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now the Earth Calendar. We continue our series on the American harvest, in which we celebrate the productivity of our good land and the bounty of our environment. It's shearing time for Lila Burley's sheep. With 400 animals, who will double their numbers come lambing time in the spring, the flock is the largest in western Massachusetts. Lila stands at the sorting table in the corner of a large old New England barn. Pens of 20 to 30 sheep fill the rest of the enclosure. A bumper hay crop is in the mow above. A white 9-pound fleece is spread out in front of her. It's all in one piece and looks a lot like a sheepskin rug. The freshly shorn ewe, released by the shearer who works nearby, scampers away. Lila separates the belly wool, picks over the fleece, and comments on this year's wool harvest.
This year, all of the animals, we've shorn over 200 this year already, and they are having better fleeces than they had last year. And if you remember, last year was very dry, and so the grass they were on was not as good, and they did not grow as long fleeces. This year, we have a really bumper crop of fleeces.
Shearing the sheep is Kevin Ford, who says he is the only full-time professional hand shearer in the United States. Unlike his counterparts who use electric clippers, the hand shearer leaves about an inch of wool on the animal, like a heavy sweater. This means that shearing can take place at this time of year, even though cold weather is setting in. Kevin describes the advantage of shearing now as he holds his sheep on its back between his legs and clips it.
Well, there's several advantages. One is that they'll be in shock free from the lamb, which is nice for the farmer and nice for the sheep. Keeps everything clean and dry, and the lambs can get at the nipples without the danger of sucking some manure tags, dirty wool. And it provides a cleaner fleece, because from now on the sheep will be on hay, and hay tends to get into the wool and contaminate it with vegetable matter, which doesn't wash out.
Shearing a sheep with hand shears is a special skill. The 6-inch blades are honed with a soft Arkansas stone after each animal. Kevin Ford learned in Ireland and honed his skills in New Zealand. On a good day, he can shear between 50 and 75 sheep at about 5 minutes apiece. He takes us through the process.
Now we start with the belly, put the sheep between our legs, and the brisket down to the crotch, and then the crotch area, starting with the inside of the right leg. Then we go to the outside of the right leg, outside of the left leg, and clear up to the hip bone, and then around to the dock and over the dock, which is the tail. And then up to the neck below, which goes from the brisket up to the chin, and then the off face, which is the face away from me, the left side of the head, and then that breaks open the wool, separates the wool.
That is Kevin Ford, the nation's only full-time professional sheep shearer that uses hand shears rather than an electric clipper. Given increasing concern about whether agriculture is sustainable, I asked Lila Burley whether her granddaughters would be able to harvest wool and lamb on the land as she does.
This land really is suitable for sheep. It is not suitable for much else. And the sheep, if you keep moving them and grazing them gently on the land, only enhance it. They add minerals and their waste products. We even put our wool clips back on the land and, you know, the things that are not suitable for textiles. So it's really exciting to think that you can make almost a golf course out of a wasteland. And this is what happens when you manage sheep properly on land that otherwise would not be productive.
Lila Burley is a shepherdess and farmer in Berkshire County, Massachusetts. Her husband is host of the Environment Show. As the winter progresses, you may be one of those people who puts on a synthetic fiber garment made out of recycled plastic soda bottles. Some people think that's good for the environment, but we haven't found a soda bottle yet that either enhances the soil or adds to the scenery when scattered around the landscape. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 361. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goishman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.